Now, however, he plays the hypocrite, and runs a sort of Y.M.California. But, I broke in, the YMCA do a lot of useful work on the battlefront, and you need not pay too much attention to their pie jaw. He hurriedly answered, yes, quite so. I meant really a show like the Salvation Army. His object, I believe, is to obtain unlimited power, and he is fairly sharp. So he started an organization to rescue the newly slain, as he puts it, and to warn them against the dangers of life on this plane. He thunders about hell, and says people must not do this and must not do that if they want to get to heaven. In short, takes the same sort of line that a revivalist does on earth. Just as if we have not already proved that all that stuff is moonshine. If the fellow had been some saintly parson on earth, one could understand it, but when you learn what sort of chap he was, you can only stand aghast at such an arrant humbug and amazed at the number of fools whom he has gulled. His sole object appears to be to gain unlimited power and influence, and the worst of it is he contrives to render the lives of all his subordinates a dreary Sabbath. He seems to delight in preventing them enjoying any of the joys of life and at turning them from jolly good fellows into a pack of killjoys. Some of us, who had learned what life over here really was, determined to take a hand in his game. We copied his organization, but cut out all the pie jaw. Mind you, we don't want blackguards, but we do want men. Everyone is free. If he wants to go to church he can do so, no one will even laugh at him, but we do bar cant and humbug of any sort. Our motto is, believe what you like and do what you like, so long as you don't make a nuisance of yourself to the community. If you do we put our foot down without wasting time. And a jolly good motto, too, I replied, and with that he left me. I soon found my feet, and got very pally with the little lady. She told me she had been dead 3 years. She was married, and hadn't a very great opinion of her husband who seemed to have been rather a fool, according to her story. I began to make love to her, and she was by no means backwards, I can assure you. The club, by the way, was a residential one, and I slept there, had my meals there, and generally made it my headquarters. I learned various details about their organization, which was copied in almost every detail from the one founded by the officer. Parties went constantly down to the battlefields to bring in fresh recruits, but I did not make one of them. Truth to tell, I was otherwise occupied. I and the little lady, I shall continue to call her by that name, went about together everywhere. We visited theaters and went to soirees, to concerts, balls, and other forms of amusement. The more mental forms of amusement succeeded my expectations, but those which were of a more physical type somehow failed to satisfy. At length, I proposed to my friend that we should get married. She laughed, and said, "My dear boy, you have forgotten the old text, they neither marry nor give in marriage, but don't look so glum. It's not so bad as it sounds. If you really wish to have a parson spouting over our heads, you can, but remember as we can't die here, it might be a bit awkward later. You'll get tired of me in time, and as we can't die, we shall have to get divorced. Besides, there is no advantage in being married as we can't have children. That's the sole object of a legal marriage on earth. But there, you shall have all the joys of matrimony without its responsibilities. But have you had a really decent drink over here, one like you used to have on earth?" I admitted I had not, and that the drinks one got at the bill simply made one crave for more and brought no real satisfaction. You haven't learned how to drink, and until you know how you won't possibly understand how to get married here. You trot along to your friend the captain, and ask him to give you a wrinkle or two. I soon found the captain, and explained what had happened. I'll soon show you how to get a drink, a proper drink, and the little lady can then explain how to get married. Here, T, take our young friend down to earth again, and initiate him. So T, and I went off together. He ceased for a moment, apparently trying to pull himself together to make the further revelations, which he felt to be of a most unpleasant nature. The officer spoke to me, RLW, it's a devilish clever scheme. I have known for some time that they were working against us, but this is the best account I have had yet. Note the ingenuity displayed. The real controlling entities keep absolutely in the background. If they dealt with these young fellows direct, their evil natures would be so evident that the youngsters would avoid them like poison. So they get other men, themselves newcomers, and not wholly bad, to do their work. As it is almost impossible for one man to deceive another here, they trade upon their ignorance rather than upon deliberate deception. The members of the counter-organization have no real knowledge of the absolute wickedness of obsession, nor of its terrible results. They have a smattering of knowledge about this plane, and none of the spirit plane, and so can genuinely think what they say about me and it. It is clever, too, how they utilize the truth about my former evil life, and yet miss its real significance. Then, too, imitation of our organization is absolutely diabolically clever, for it catches the unwary in a trap. Again, the gentle, downward path, at first appearing perfectly innocent. The appeal to the material and earthly instincts of their victims, and the way in which such an attitude is justified by the apparently earthly surroundings in which the newly slain find themselves, shows that there is a mastermind at work. But the subaltern wants to continue his narrative. Chapter 8, the subaltern continues his story. The later continued, he took me down to the earth plane, where we entered a famous nightclub in the West End. We passed through the walls, which seemed wan and shadowy, into the saloon, where we saw many mortals dancing, and many astrals watching them. From thence we entered a bar where men and women were seated at tables, drinking liqueurs and various other drinks. "What would you like?" my companion inquired. "A good stiff whiskey and soda," I replied. "Do as I do," he remarked, and began to twine himself round one of the drinkers in a most extraordinary manner. There were several men drinking really heavily, and I tried each in turn, but could not find out the knack. At last, after closely watching several other astrals, I discovered the secret, just as the show was coming to an end. I got my drink, however. The effect was extraordinary, and more closely resembled drinking whiskey on earth than any of my previous experiences in the astral club. But as soon as the mortal threw me off, and staggered out of the room, the craving grew on me and I longed for another. Tea took me to a large hotel, but owing to the drink restrictions, we found the private bar empty. There were other astrals there already, but I could not restrain my impatience, and going behind the bar tried to pull out the cork of a bottle of brandy. Of course I could effect nothing, so wandered up and down impatiently till at last the doors were opened, and customers began to enter. Most of them were quite moderate drinkers who took a glass or two and then went about their business. We rushed at them, but were quite unable to get hold of them. At length a commercial traveller came in who had already had as much as was good for him. The landlord eyed him suspiciously, but evidently came to the conclusion that he was not sufficiently far gone to justify a refusal to serve him. There was a rush for this man, and being less cunning than the rest, I was shouldered aside, and had the great mortification of seeing another astral finally obtain control, though not till after a fierce struggle with tea. Presently the landlord refused to serve the commercial with any more liquor, and the man went out cursing, and the astral with him still entwined with his body. As the day wore on others came in, and at last I got my chance, and attached myself to a card sharper, through whom I obtained several drinks. At 2:30 we were all turned out, and I stuck like glue to the card sharper. He had bought a couple of bottles of whiskey, and went off with two others to a dingy little office in Pimlico. The three men sat round a dusty table, telling yarns and drinking hard till they had finished not only my man's two bottles, but three others which the other two had bought. One of the men collapsed in a drunken stupor, but the other two, though a bit dazed, pulled themselves together and, after being violently sick, started out again. While they were feeling sick, I felt the same, and I also felt very stupid. I felt as though I could not leave these two, although I had had enough of the whole business. I had to go with my man, who drifted into a very second-rate pub in the Euston Road, and there began to work various card tricks. He drank fairly heavily, and I with him. I found now that I could not get away, try as I would, and began to regret my conduct most bitterly. In the midst of one of his cleverest guard tricks, he was arrested by one of his supposed dupes, who revealed himself as an astute detective, who had been put on his track. His confederate was also arrested, and the pair taken off in custody. While in jail he was, of course, unable to obtain any liquor, and by degrees I found the invisible chain which bound him to me growing weaker. At length I shook myself free, and after wandering about the earth plane, succeeded in returning to the club of the astral plane. Here I met my lady friend, to whom I described my adventures, but when I went on to say how disgusted I was about the whole business, and how ashamed of myself, she rather laughed at me, and said, "You were new to this business and overdid it. You must be more moderate in future, then you won't get tied to the mortal." She then explained that we could get married in a similar manner. I was rather afraid of a second experiment after my first, but for fear of being laughed at by her, and called a milksop, I consented. I need not go into the whole business. You probably understand the whole beastly affair better than I do. But you have to bear in mind that this was a more complicated business than the last one. There were two of us and two mortals needed to complete the experiment, but at length we were successful. After a time the vice seemed to grip both us and the mortals in a fiendish grip, and though after a time we tired of each other and of our mortal victims, we were unable to get free. At length the man became ill, and this, as in the case of the card sharper's imprisonment, procured my release. My lady friend also obtained her freedom, but by now she was tired of me, and took up with another astral officer. I should doubtless have drifted back into my old ways had it not been for my mother. I was startled one day by hearing my Christian name shouted in my ear. I looked round, but there was no one, and again my name was called. I seemed to be drawn in the direction from whence it came. As I drew nearer, I recognized my mother's voice. My pace increased, and I found myself in her room. She was praying. As I heard her prayers, my heart was filled with remorse, and I realized how degraded I was becoming. She was grieving still for me, and I rushed instinctively towards her, but was instantly hurled back by some tremendous power. So I turned and fled in utter misery, not knowing where to go. I would not go back to the club. I felt somehow that it was the cause of all my troubles, so went back to the battlefield, of all unlikely places. It was more by instinct than from any intelligent reason, but I fancy it was because I had made a false start, and wanted to begin all over again. Almost at once I was picked up by a man belonging to the officers' organization. At first I thought it was one of the old gang and told him to be off, but he stuck tight to me, and after a while he said something about the officer. At once I remembered the captain's attack on the officer. I promptly said to myself, "That last organization led me astray. It was a vowedly a counterblast to this one. Perhaps, after all, this is a good organization." By now I was feeling desperately lonely, and moreover, the old desires were coming back. I felt that if I did not get with someone who would help me to keep away from these temptations, I should have to give way to them. So I determined to chance it. So I told the private to lead me to the officer himself. He demurred at first, but I insisted, and at length he did so. As soon as I saw him, I felt the magic of his influence. He seemed to sum me up in a moment. He was strong, and I gained new strength from his proximity, which helped me to resist the terrible temptations which were beginning to worry me once more. Now, I've told you everything I can remember. I'm thoroughly ashamed of myself. This obsessing is a horrible habit. It's like drug taking on earth, and once started grows and grows on one till it becomes absolutely one's master. The officer has been a brick, and without his help I should have given up the struggle. When he had finished, the officer turned to me, RLW, and said, "We'll go into the next room, and talk things over. The subaltern will be all right while Lieutenant C is about." We talked matters over, and the officer decided to call a general council, and sent out thought messages accordingly. He just called the people he wanted mentally, and they knew, even if they were down on the earth plane. "But it's time I broke off, this is a suitable moment." So I, JW, said goodbye to all three, and returned to Earth. Chapter 9, The First Act of Open War. December 11, 1917. I arrived at RLW's house without any untoward incident, and after greeting all three, RLW continued his narrative. The matter of this counter-organization was discussed from every point of view, and we finally determined upon a definite line of action. Some of the more hot-headed advocated an attack on the club, but the officer refused to allow this, although he admitted it had several attractive features. Instead, arrangements were made to picket all roads leading to it, and as our organization had grown to a huge concern, we had no difficulty in placing squads of 50 men, under their proper officers, at all important points. Groups were also told off to shadow their expeditions, and endeavored to counteract their machinations. I was given charge of one of the pickets, which took up its position close to the main gates of the club. The officer warned me that we might be attacked by the members of the club, but he said that this would only happen after they had exhausted all means of persuasion. If attacked, I had simply to send out a thought call, and it would be answered by reinforcements. Well, we started work at once, and soon were spied from the club. Several girls came out and asked us to come in. Of course, I refused, and the other men ignored their presence. Other attempts on the part of the fair sex were equally unsuccessful, and in the midst of one of them a party approached the club from the direction of the battlefield. There were about a dozen newly slain and 15 of the counter-organization. I shall call the latter the enemy henceforward. As the newcomers approached, our picket spread out, and intercepted them. My men at once began to reason with the newly slain, but this naturally did not suit the enemy, who peremptorily ordered the former out of the way. We refused to move, and the enemy threatened to use force. The situation was noted by those in the club, and one of their officers led out a company of their men. He wasted few words. All he said was, "Now then, clear out or there will be trouble." I answered him, "We won't clear out." I formed my men into a square just in time, and there was a regular rough and tumble. At first they used only their butts, but soon took to the bayonet, and so did we. Meanwhile, I was sending out calls for help, and our neighboring pickets broke into the grounds, and running across caught the enemy in the rear. They put up a stiff fight, though, and were constantly being reinforced from the club. The struggle grew more bitter. Meanwhile, the newly slain looked on amazed, unable to decide on which side to cast in their lot, though they seemed to be itching for a scrap. At length an Irishman called out, "Begad, I don't know what the row's about, but I'm not going to be out of such a lovely scrap." So saying, he hit the nearest man on the head with his rifle. This man happened to be one of the enemy, so they went for him. Several of his friends backed him up, but a Scotsman promptly went on the other side just because he was an Irishman. Soon all were involved except two privates and an officer, who drew out of the press and watched the scrimmage with a puzzled air. But my calls for aid had reached the officer, who came into action with several regiments, at least 10,000 men. But what really turned the day, I believe, was his tremendous will. He seemed to dominate the whole situation. I never saw such conclusive proof of the power of the will before in all my life. The enemy seemed to lose heart at once. Some surrendered, others broke away and fled. When the fight was finished, we found we had captured 60 of their men and 7 of the newly slain, counting friends and foes. The Scotsman had escaped, and the 3 neutrals were still looking on. RLW paused for a moment at this point and said, "You seemed surprised that we nearly all had weapons. Well, we are organized on a military basis, and every soldier gets the idea absolutely drilled into him that he must never be without his rifle. It becomes almost a fetish. What more natural than that he should take one about with him on the astral plane? It's quite easy to get one, for there are thousands of broken rifles lying about on the battlefields of Earth, and, therefore, their astral forms are ready to hand." Again, nearly all the men who belonged to either side in the struggle had fought for a while on the astral plane, and when they left it, brought their weapons with them. Most of the newcomers, for the same reason, had rifles with them, and used them. The young officer and one of the privates who stood aside during the scrap had not, the other private had. I'll explain why the officer and the first private had no weapons presently. The Scotsman had no weapon to start with. But he tore a rifle out of the grasp of one of my men. Cartridges. The same rule applies, but we soon ran out of ammunition. A man does not carry a large quantity of ammunition about with him on Earth, but relies on the general supply which is usually brought into the firing line by others who are detailed off for the work. Not much damage was caused by the fighting to the grounds. The hedge was broken down a little, and did not recover like the men did. You see, inanimate objects have little, if any, will of their own. Nothing, at any rate, which can put itself against the will of a man. We willed to destroy it so as to get through during the fighting, so it was broken. The fighting in general closely resembled the fighting in the great astral battle, so I need not go into it any further, and will continue my narrative. The officer now issued the following commands: we will now blockade this place. RLWY not storm the place and drive these swine out, the officer. Because fighting generates evil passions at all times, and would only harden their hearts, as the Bible would say. On the other hand, these people have grown to crave for food. It's not necessary for them, but indulgence in this craving has made them gross and material, and inclined to gratify their appetites by even worse methods. Deprived of astral food, they will be compelled to realize that they don't need it, and after a while some will begin to lose the craving for it. This will lead to an improvement in their spiritual and even in their mental outlook. We shall, therefore, find them easier to reason with when they surrender. If we stormed the place, they would be angry and rebellious. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to keep beings prisoners against their will for any long time, and I am doubtful whether we should be justified in attempting to do so. You cannot compel a man to be converted. I have, however, no scruples about applying this amount of coercion. I, J.W., here interrupted. Just a minute. What happens to the astral form of astral food when it is eaten? RLW, its astral elements are broken up, and take a new astral form, which rapidly breaks up and vanishes. It passes out in just the same way that earthy waste does. But it does not really nourish the astral body. You see, astral food has no will to resist destruction. But we could not capture an animal and kill and cook it, because the animal has a will of its own, and would resist. J.W. What about the astral form of a leg of mutton? RLW, I never saw one. But the only foods I ate when I made my experiment were foods derived from vegetable matter. Cereals, for example, apples, and so forth. If they had any willpower, it's so weak that it hardly counts. H.J. Elder is a marked difference in this point between the astral world and the spirit realms. No forms of food come to us. They pass to hell, and there constitute the menus for the feasts of Tantalus, with which that place abounds. You get the form of your roast leg of mutton there, but though you may carve it up and eat it, not only do you get no satisfaction therefrom, but you find the leg of mutton appears intact at the end of the banquet if there is an end. All the forms of all the filth of the world go likewise to hell, added Rex. RLW then resumed his story. The officer thought for a moment, and then said, there are about 1,300 people in there, including those in the private's club. There are about 500 men on picket duty. If I leave 2,000 more, that should be sufficient. You, adjutant, by the way, Jack, he was a colonel by this time, will take charge with the acting rank of a brigadier. The rest of the force are needed on the battle plane. Our forces are hard pressed, and all sending out SOS calls. I think you, Rex, had better take in hand our young friend here, and explain matters to him. Colonel S. will take charge of the prisoners, and return with them to headquarters. We will try what a little reasoning will do before we let the enemy go, and I think some will join us. Hang on to them till I return. The newcomers will present little difficulty, you will find. He turned to the adjutant. Brigadier, you will have to exercise all vigilance. It's true that about one third of those in the club are women, but you will find them quite as dangerous as the men. In some cases more dangerous, for our men will not like to use force against them. However, no one must leave the club if you can possibly prevent it. Above all, no reinforcements or food must be introduced from outside. I leave you in charge with perfect confidence." In a few moments he was out of sight, taking with him the bulk of the troops. The adjutant I left in the middle of his task, and took charge of the three astrals. Colonel S. started off towards headquarters with his prisoners and the rescued. Most of the latter were already on our side, and promptly fell to at the rear of the column. We walked along with the officer, leaving a sergeant in charge of the two privates, so as to give myself greater freedom with young Captain B. The following is the story of his death, and since it is typical of many men who die of wounds, as distinct from those who are killed instantly, I will give it in detail. Chapter 10, How Captain B. Died of His Wounds. Captain B. began, "This seems a funny sort of place. I did think I'd get quit of fighting when I died. Let's hear about your death." "I, RLW, said, "I was hit by a piece of shell in the stomach as we were advancing across no man's land. I lay on the ground in agony for hours. Dawn was breaking, and men stumbled over me as succeeding waves of men went forward. After a time, loss of blood and pain made me faint. I came to later as the sun was setting. The Huns were shelling our lines and no man's land in front of them. I longed for a shell to hit me and put me out of my agony, but my luck was out. Again I fainted, and when I recovered I felt dazed but experienced little pain. I watched in a detached sort of way the pool of blood which lay at one side of me. I made no effort to get up. I felt tired out. I remembered I felt like that once before. I cut my arms when a boy fell through a cucumber frame and cut my arms rather badly. The loss of blood made me feel faint, but I felt no pain. I remembered the incident quite clearly. Then other incidents passed through my mind, often trivial matters with no real significance, and mostly drawn from childhood's experiences. Once more I became unconscious, and when I recovered I found myself in complete darkness. I groped round, but could find no familiar object, but I realized that I no longer felt weak and tired. I moved my legs, rose to my feet, and tried to walk about, but soon felt myself held as if by a rope. I hunted for this rope, and found it was attached in some mysterious way to my head. I caught hold of it and tugged, but could not loosen it. So I ran my hand downwards till I came to the place where it ended, in nothing. This puzzled me a good deal, and I sat down to think things over. After a while I began to get used to the darkness which resembled a dense fog, and perceived amid it darker shadows, some of which flitted to and fro, while others lay still. Suddenly I heard voices close by, even recognized one of them as that of my batman, so I called out to him. He said, "I am sure I can hear the captain's voice," I shouted louder than ever. The shadow moved nearer. "Apostrophe look out," I cried, and it walked clean through me. It knelt down near a shadowy heap which lay close beside me, and another man knelt also near this heap, and seemed to be doing something to it. I was tremendously puzzled, and thought, "I am evidently delirious, but they have found me. I doubt, however, if they are in time." But the other man suddenly cried, "He's gone, poor fellow." My batman replied, "But, sir, I heard him call. Imagination, my man, or perhaps some other poor fellow. In fact, I can hear someone even now. But, sir, I know his voice. I—" "Rubbish. The man has been dead for 2 or 3 hours. Best take the body back, hadn't we?" inquired another voice. "Yes, you two can manage it. Now, you other men, this way." The shadowy form was lifted by the two other shadows, and as it began to move away I felt myself dragged in the same direction. I got up and followed them, puzzling my brains as to what it all meant. They stopped. I heard the words of the burial service, then silence. The men turned to go, and for the last time I heard my batman's voice. "It's strange, Harry, but I could swear it was his voice, and what's more, I'm sure I've heard it several times since." "Apostrophe you're upset, chum," replied the other, "enough to give anyone the jumps. He was a decent sort." I heard no more. I was dead, and yet alive. What did it all mean? I passed my hands over my body and face. I had a body, and yet they had buried something. Why could I not get away? I gave a desperate tug. I nearly skipped with joy. I could move. I was free.